bar for lunch and burgers and hand-cut steaks for dinner. Online at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. Cloudy tonight, lows 28 to 32.
Hello, I'm Neve Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
Conflict resolution. Now that Donald Trump is returning to the White House, a Ukrainian MP tells us she's worried he'll try to make good on his claim that he can end the war with Russia in just one day, and wonders what her country might lose in the process.
And to the naked eye, a Welsh gallery owner responds to a local kerfuffle over a display of nude art with a whole lot more nudes. And she's calling the exhibit of life drawing an homage to the lifeblood of art itself.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Wednesday edition of As It Happens.
There is more ahead from As It Happens on KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. We're going to take a quick listen to our album of the week, and then we'll hear the set list. Our album of the week is Last Leaf on the Tree by Willie Nelson. It is his 76th solo album. He is now 91 years old. It is a covers album, and the songs chosen are perfect for Nelson's voice today. And Willie's son, Micah, who produced and curated the album, said the theme of the album was facing death with grace. You can let us know what you think. Text us 218-326-1234. The song we're going to hear this evening is a Tom Waits cover, House Where Nobody Lives.
There's a house on my block that's abandoned and cold. The folks moved out a long time ago, and they took all their things and they never came back. It looks like it's haunted with the windows all cracked. Everyone calls it the house where nobody lives. Once it held laughter, once it held dreams. Did they throw it away? Did they know what it means? Did someone's heart break? Or did someone do somebody wrong? Well, the paint's all cracked. It was peeled off the wood. And the papers were stacked on the porch where I stood. And the weeds had grown up just as high as the door. There were birds in the chimney and an old chest of drawers. Looks like no one will ever come back to the house where nobody lives. Once it
This is the setlist on KAXC, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are looking at Thursday, Friday, and Saturday this week, November 7th through November 9th, with shows in Gilbert, Brainerd, Aiken, and Bemidji. Rich Matson is playing a solo show at the Ore House in Gilbert this Thursday at 6 p.m. The longtime Minnesota rocker is known for his band the North Stars and numerous other groups like the Glen Russells, Old Yeller, and the Tisdales. The Ore House show will be a recurring event the first Thursdays of the month. And the Fire in the Village Collective continue their Northern Minnesota tour this weekend, Friday night at the Gitche Zibe Center for the Arts in Brainerd, 6 p.m., and Saturday night at Sampaguita in Aiken at the same time. along with a fashion show and interactive printmaking. Folk singer Annie Humphrey and Americana singer David Huckfeldt will perform. For more information on the collective and their events, find a conversation with the group at kaxc.org. Then Minnesota singer-songwriter Peter Mayer will be at the Headwaters Peace Center in Bemidji Saturday night at 7 p.m. A folk singer active since the 90s, Mayer is known for his humorous songs about the mysteries of life. Again, that's at the Headwaters Peace Center in Bemidji Saturday night. At the same time, folk singer Scarlett Woods will be at Bemidji Brewing. Woods released her latest album, Letters to the West, last year, showcasing her personal lyrics and jazz background. She specializes in seven-string jazz guitar. At 7 p.m. Saturday at Bemidji Brewing. Do you have information on live music you'd like us to know about? Email comments at kaxc.org. This set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Party down. Kamala Harris concedes the presidency to Donald Trump after his win. And Dean Phillips, who challenged Joe Biden for the leadership of the Democratic Party, tells us what he thinks went wrong.
Southern discomfort. Canada's economists are calculating the costs of Mr. Trump's threatened tariffs, but Industry Minister François-Philippe Champagne tells us he is keeping calm.
Speaking truce to power, the president-elect has promised he'll somehow end the war in Ukraine in just one day. A Ukrainian MP tells us making a peace deal isn't the problem. It's holding Vladimir Putin to it.
A voice in the wilderness. Montana's first openly trans lawmaker, Zoe Zephyr, thanks voters for re-electing her and promises to stand up against those who seek to break democracy.
I put a misspell on you. A lawsuit claims a French company has been fraudulently adding pirated music to streaming services attributed to artists like Rihanna, Ariana Grande, and Jutin Bieber.
And what else is nude? After getting a dressing down from police about an allegedly pornographic artwork, a Welsh gallery owner decides she should have more skin in the game. As it happens, the Wednesday edition, Radio That Figures, booty is in the eye of the beholder.
In our nation, we owe loyalty not to a president or a party, but to the Constitution of the United States. And loyalty to our conscience and to our God. My allegiance to all three is why I am here to say, while I concede this election, I do not concede the fight that fueled this campaign.
U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris conceding the presidential race to Donald Trump in a speech at Howard University this afternoon. With control of the Senate, a majority of the popular vote, and wins in battleground states, it is a decisive victory for the president-elect and the Republican Party. A more decisive outcome than the polling suggested, and a very different outcome from what Democrats hoped for or expected. Dean Phillips is a Democratic congressman who sought to replace Joe Biden as his party's candidate for the presidency last year, making him one of a few Democrats to openly argue that the president was unfit to run again well before Kamala Harris took over. Mr. Phillips' campaign stalled out, and he decided not to seek re-election to Congress. We reached Dean Phillips at home in Minnesota.
Congressman Phillips, is this how you expected this race to end?
Nothing that I, or frankly most Americans, expected has proven out, but that's the way the cookie crumbles, and democracy sometimes works. It was heartbreaking to hear those words today, as you can imagine, for those of us who value this democracy, who value the principles of the Democratic Party, and who saw great potential when President Biden stepped aside. Mm-hmm. But you're talking to an optimistic congressman here, and I'm hopeful for the future.
Vice President Harris also, in that concession speech, said she was proud of the race that they ran and how we ran it. She said, from where you sit, though, what is the lesson you want the Democratic Party to take away from this loss?
This is a zero-sum game. And like horseshoes and hand grenades, close doesn't really matter. And I'm disappointed. I'd be kidding you if I said otherwise. We had a historic opportunity, $1 billion. But at the end of the day, strategy, and perhaps most importantly, you know, listening to voters.
What did they not listen to in this campaign?
I'll tell you, when I initiated my challenge to President Biden in the primaries, not because I didn't respect him, admire him, and consider him a competent leader, but because I saw the writing on the wall, I called attention to what Americans were talking about. The lack of affordability in housing and groceries because of inflation, a very porous southern border here in the United States, and a general feeling of people being disenfranchised, frowned upon, unheard, unappreciated. And that was palpable to many of us who were paying attention. But it was hard to get the attention of the powers that be, which often is the case.
Do you think ultimately Biden would have been a better candidate, or that there should have been a primary contest after he dropped out?
No, I don't think Biden would have been a better candidate, although, according to all the data I've seen, there's not a single United States county in which Vice President Harris outperformed Joe Biden's 2020 performance, which is a staggering data point. With that said, no, I think Joe Biden would have lost even more handily to Donald Trump. And the answer to your question is yes. We needed to have a thoughtful, engaging, and spirited primary. And the disinterest in inspiring a competition, promoting it, in fact, we suppressed it. But it is the absence of a competition that I'm afraid led us to this very sad day for Democrats and, frankly, for people around the world.
Did Kamala Harris do anything during this campaign and that concession speech that surprised you in a positive way, that you thought that she did do some good for the party here?
This sounds bizarre, and I can't even believe I have to say it, but the fact that she conceded in the way that we do so in this country and certainly in Canada and developed democracies around the world, sadly, we can't take that for granted anymore. Vice President Harris is a competent, compassionate, decent woman of great experience, and I think her message was a good one. You know, sadly, the campaign she ran did not connect with voters, but at least her principles and her character shined through. If Donald Trump had been on the other end of this election last night and lost, rest assured, his speech would not have been a concession.
Members of Donald Trump's own inner circle, as you know, have described him as a fascist. He has said he'll be a, quote, dictator on day one. He's talked about deploying the military against, quote, the enemy from within. Given all of that, I hear what you and others have said about the economy, but why were the Democrats not able to break through, given how that threat to democracy was so widely felt and perceived by so many voters?
I think your question is an important one that Democrats should be asking themselves right now. How is it possible that this country can elect a man like that? And as I say to so many, we have employed too much condemnation and not enough invitation. I happen to be someone who values democracy, have grave concerns about President-elect Trump's intentions, and happen to be someone who was trapped in the U.S. Capitol chamber on the January 6th tragedy that he inspired and did nothing to end. So, of course, I'm concerned, but clearly 60-plus million Americans felt quite differently.
You mentioned your optimism at the outset of our conversation. You've said in the past you don't believe the American public is as divided as they're made out to be, but this was a divisive campaign, certainly. It was open racism and misogyny from the Trump campaign. What do you say to Americans who don't want to find common ground or don't know how to find common ground after that?
Sure. Well, like anything else, it takes practice, and we have what I refer to as an angertainment industry. That would have Americans believe we're more divided than we are, that the industry that's earning billions upon billions of dollars dividing us. And I do believe, though, at heart, human beings are good people. Americans are good people. And we are now self-selecting where we live with those who see things the same way, who think, pray, eat, and live the same way we do. And that is antithetical to the melting pot that is both the United States and Canada, frankly. And my message to my fellow Americans is to, you know, get off the TVs, put down the phones, and get out and take a walk and say hello to neighbors. And as I found during my presidential run, people are good. They want to be heard. They want to be appreciated. They want to be respected. And I think we politicians have a responsibility to open our own hearts and minds. And like I said, use invitation and not condemnation. So believe it or not, I am disappointed today, but I'm optimistic.
Congressman, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Anytime. Thank you so much.
Dean Phillips is a Democratic congressman and one-time Joe Biden challenger. We reached him in Minneapolis. People all over the world were anxiously awaiting the results of last night's election, perhaps no one more anxiously than Ukrainians. 2.5 years into Russia's invasion, Ukraine is struggling to recruit soldiers and losing territory in the east, where North Korean soldiers are waiting in the Kursk region. Against that backdrop, a lot of Ukrainians have been preoccupied by what a Donald Trump win would mean for their country. Early this morning, a victorious president-elect had this to say.
You know, we had no wars, 4 years, we had no wars, except we defeated ISIS. But we had no wars. They said, he will start a war. I'm not going to start a war. I'm going to stop wars.
Mr. Trump's comments follow promises on the campaign trail that if elected, he would end the war in Ukraine within 24 hours. And today, some, including this Kyiv resident, said they are holding him to that promise.
This Trump promised to stop the war in just one day. We are all waiting for it. So now he is 47th president of the U.S., of the biggest and greatest country in the world. We are waiting for this straight move, stop the war in just one day. It could be today, tomorrow. We can wait till Friday. You're the president. Please do it, Mr. Trump.
That's Kyiv resident Alexei Rocha speaking to the BBC. Kira Rudik is a member of parliament in Ukraine and leader of the Golos party. She's in Kyiv.
Kira Rudik, when you hear a comment like that, do you agree? Do you expect there's going to be a speedy conclusion, an end to this war because of these election results in the U.S.?
Well, I think during the campaign, Donald Trump was giving simple solutions to the complicated problems. And for us, ending the war in just one day would perhaps mean that we will have to forfeit some of our territories and that it will not be a winning of the war for Ukraine. This is why, of course, people are worried and people are afraid. And we, as politicians, remain optimistic, hoping that by the time when Donald Trump actually becomes a president in January, we will be able to get more information to his administration so that we will not be forced into having a peace deal that we are not ready for. And as of right now, the President Zelensky said that the support that the United States promised us, the only 10% of that has been delivered since the beginning of the year. And this is a disaster because you cannot win the war with just 10% of what you need to fight it, right?
Advisors to Donald Trump this summer, you'll likely remember, put a plan forward that they said would end the war. It involves saying to Ukraine that Ukraine would only get more weapons from the U.S. if it would enter peace talks, and was also warning Moscow that if it refused to negotiate, that would mean more U.S. support for Ukraine. Do you feel that a new Trump administration, you know, how are you assessing their ability to broker a peace deal and also potentially get you the military support you're asking for?
Well, the truth is we don't know. I know one thing for sure, and that we know for a fact, is as of right now, there is not a person or an organization in the world that can pressure Putin to keep his part of the deal. We have seen that when we entered peace talks with Russia in 2014, and we had a deal with them that led us towards the situation that we have right now. So the question for the U.S. administration would not be if they can like pressure us, but can they get Putin to agree to something and keep his part of the bargain? And well, I am absolutely sure that the answer is no.
Donald Trump has, of course, praised Vladimir Putin. In 2019, he did also supply Ukraine with weaponry and put in new rounds of sanctions. But Vladimir Putin today said he had no plans to congratulate Donald Trump. What does that signal to you?
Russia always lies. And we have seen basically at their propagandist TV channels how happy they were that Kamala Harris did not win. They were very vocal about that. But the question remains, can someone predict how Donald Trump will act? I don't think there is anyone who can do that. So from our side, we need to concentrate to be able to present the Republican Party and new administration with the adequate plan on what we are going to do. And second, to work with our European allies, because what Trump was very vocal about as well is that the war on the European continent needs to be a bother of the and responsibility of the European countries. So we can anticipate that there would be a pressure within NATO to increase the support from our European allies if the support from the United States will decrease.
There's another factor in all of this. Vice President-elect J.D. Vance, he has been very critical of any U.S. assistance to your country. And after Russia invaded back in February of 2022, he said to a podcaster, quote, "I got to be honest with you. I don't really care what happens to Ukraine one way or another," unquote. How do those words sit with you, even if they're from a few years ago?
Well, it is painful, of course, because we see the United States as the leader of the democratic world. And how good of a leader you can be if you cannot support the ones who are fighting for the same values as you state you are fighting for. And I think right now we need to be very honest with the things that were said during the campaigning may not be exactly things that will be drivers of the decision making for the new administration.
Does that give you hope then, or worry you more?
It does give me hope in some ways, because even if we are talking about right now or February or January, when Trump will actually be voted in, sworn in as a president, right? We know that there could be like totally different situations politically. And then when you as a leader of the United States will have to deal with issues like China and a conflict in Israel, Gaza, et cetera, I think you will weigh more on how your actions are seen through the authoritarian regimes of the world. And I think leaving Ukraine up to dry is not a signal that you really want to send to China, Iran, North Korea, and Russia, right? Saying, well, you can do whatever you want and then get away with it.
There's quite an effusive congratulations on social media from Volodymyr Zelensky today, you know, calling it an impressive election victory, appreciating Trump's commitment to, quote, peace through strength, unquote, approach. I mean, obviously, there has to be bridge building, and that's some of that. But what do you think Mr. Zelensky needs to say to Trump to get the kind of outcome you and many Ukrainians are hoping for?
I think President Zelensky actually have said that what we are looking for is to invite President Trump to Ukraine. We have seen with different leaders being hesitant in supporting us and that their visit and look people in the eye here have changed their perspective. And I want to be pragmatic, but I also have seen how people who are talking about abstract things after they have seen Bucha in Irpin and destroyed cities and children having to bury their parents, it's changing for a politician, it's changing for a human being. So I think the best bet is to bring Donald Trump and his team here to Ukraine and let them see.
Kira Rudik, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, and glory to Ukraine.
Kira Rudik is a member of parliament in Ukraine. We reached her in Kyiv. In September, the small Welsh market town of Hay-on-Wye was rocked by scandal. In the window of an art gallery on the town's high street appeared a work by a young female artist, a painting of a nude woman. Some residents greeted this artwork with naked hostility. Their complaints that the painting was not art but pornography led to visits from the police, who ordered the owner and curator of the gallery, Val Harris, to take the painting down. She refused. And now, some 6 weeks later, a new exhibition graces the floor of her gallery, and the people who complained aren't likely to be much happier about this one. Val Harris is the owner and curator of two art galleries, The Chair and The Table in Hay-on-Wye, Wales. That's where we reached her.
Val, if we were to take a stroll past your gallery today, right now, what would we see in the window?
You'd see four or five pictures of the naked form, predominantly female, with one male drawing, naked, legs akimbo.
And what's the reaction to those so far?
The male nude, when they kind of clock it, because it's less vibrant than the other ones in the window, the men just kind of have a bit of a snigger about, you know, their bits and mine's bigger than yours and that kind of thing. And the women kind of raise their eyebrows but pass on, and the kids just go, oh, look, there's a willy, you know, it's fine, that's a willy, yeah. Which was in contrast to the last exhibition.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about. The painting that started everything, what about it made people so upset, do you think?
I think it was that a woman was lying on her back on a table, one imagines, or possibly on the floor, probably on the table, with glasses beside her, and her legs were in a kind of childbearing position, mm-hmm. akimbo, with a black triangle between her legs and a bit of pink wool coming out of the top of the triangle.
And what was your intention, or what did you want to put it in the window for?
There was no intention. It basically was the size, back to the size of the painting fitted the window.
And so it was logistics, in addition
it
to art.
It was logistics, art logistics. And then I went off to a meeting in a church to discuss my gongs. I play gongs in my other life with my other hat on. And suddenly I get a phone call from one of the girls saying, a woman's just come in and said that the image is pornographic, we've got to remove it from the window. I thought, well, the world's gone mad. My little town's gone mad. And I said, well, I tell you what, we'll put a little notice in the window and we'll say, if you've got any distress around this picture being here, come and talk to us about it. We're having a meeting at 4 o'clock on Thursday. Oh. And none of the objectors turned up because they've called the police, haven't they?
The police said,
yes, they came twice. I wasn't there the first day, so they came back the next day and they said, we've had two objections to this painting being in the window. We need you to remove it from the window, and you can put it in the gallery, but you can't be in the window. I said, well, I'm not removing the painting from the window because I would be compromising the integrity of my artist. Mm-hmm. And that was that. But it kind of spawned this idea that if this was really, you know, the way that people in my little local town were feeling, how would they feel if there were a few more?
Because you doubled down.
It sort of kind of crept up on me slowly. I had a gap in the schedule, the exhibition schedule. I thought, well, I could put it out on my Instagram. I could see if people were keen to submit life drawings, life paintings.
You said that call out to artists, and you received more than 50 works of art, all nudes, from 30 different artists, as I understand it. But you specifically said it's not a protest. What is it?
It's an homage. It's an homage to life drawing, which is the lifeblood for all artists. That's how I think of it. But no, most people have loved this exhibition and I've had much more footfall through the door than for the last exhibition. And they're very supportive.
Will this be the focus of the galleries you curate at now?
No, I don't want to be known as Mrs. Nude or anything like that. No. But I will do it every year. I've decided.
Why do you think ultimately in 2024, I mean, people have different, they may be comfortable with nude paintings in their home, but maybe not, well, you know, maybe there's a range of what people are comfortable with just, you know, in a window. Why do you think the female form in particular is still causing a stir?
Oh, how long have you got? Well, I don't know. I think it was shocking for me that the demographic of people complaining were women of my age. I'm in my 60s, and it was that those ladies that came in, and I think we've grown up in an environment where we were told our skirts couldn't be too short, that all that kind of stuff. And basically,
I raised a daughter where she wore the little kind of midriff stuff. And I say, oh, my God, you're going out dressed like that? But actually great, because you're not body conscious. You know, you're not being shut down. And I think I've not been shut down. I've had a holiday in France. I go topless. I kind of, you know, all that kind of stuff.
You've modeled
so
as well.
I haven't. I did. Yeah, it's funny you should say that. After my first marriage, I wanted a kind of a picture of my back, of looking to the future, not looking back over my shoulder. Mm-hmm. So I asked an artist friend if I could sit for him for the day, just so he could paint my back, draw my back. He did 10 drawings of me, and in my sort of, you know, in my 30s, and I was a little self-conscious, and then I just sort of let go. It was the most empowering thing I'd done in leaving this marriage. And I bought two of them from him, and the rest of them he gave to me when I married my second husband. And I had them framed, put them up all over the house, which was a severe embarrassment to my son at the time. But but it was great. And this is what life models say, how empowering it is. And this is what artists say when they are painting and drawing the life model.
Val, a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Oh, it's been really good fun.
Val Harris is the owner and curator of two art galleries, The Chair and The Table. We reached her in Hay on Wye, Wales. The Biggest Hits by All the Biggest Artists. Bad Romance by Lady Gaga. Bay Baby by Canadian superstar Justin Bieber. And a groovy remix of Thank You Next featuring dueling banjos by the great Ariana Grande.
Look what I got. Look what you taught me. Yeah, all that I did.
These may not be the types of artists you listen to, but they might be the typos of artists you listen to. At least that is what the Universal Music Group is alleging. This week, UMG filed a lawsuit against a French company called Believe, which it says has been, quote, operating as a hub for the distribution of infringing copies of the world's most popular copyrighted recordings, unquote. It believes that Believe is inundating streaming services with hundreds of pirated songs by big artists, songs that are sped up or slowed down or otherwise remixed in some way or other, and that Believe is attributing these songs to such artists as Lady Gaga with two L's, Kendrick Lamar, no C in Kendrick and three A's in Lamar, Ariana Grande, Rihanna, and Justin Bieber. I guess the idea is that you're in such a hurry to hear Justin Bieber that you accidentally type Justin Bieber, and then when you play the Justin Bieber song, the wrong people get the money. Mind you, Believe indignantly rejects Universal's accusations, so I guess the two parties will see each other in court. Just don't expect Ariana Grande or Rihanna to show up and testify, even though this whole thing is really giving them a bad name. Here's Basha Bulat with In the Name Of. Basha Bulat with In the Name Of.
We are going to take a short break now. When we return, Canada's industry minister, François-Philippe Champagne, tells us how he plans to deal with President-elect Donald Trump and the kind of punitive tariffs Trump talked about incessantly on the campaign trail.
And she has been muzzled by her colleagues and personally attacked over and over. But Montana's first openly trans lawmaker, Democrat Zoe Zephyr, has also been reelected. She tells us what it's been like to hear the Trump campaign's anti-trans rhetoric and why she's not giving up.
Stay tuned. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
Thank you for listening to As It Happens on KAXE. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. 7 o'clock, Malachi Coons is your host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. And at 10 o'clock, Malachi continues with new music. We receive support from Fire in the Village, a collective of artists and cultural organizers using art, music, and fashion to build community. Presenting a collection of live concert events featuring David Huckfeldt and Annie Humphrey in Grand Rapids, Bemidji, Brainerd, and Aiken this November. Showtimes and locations are available at fireinthevillage.org. Programming is also supported in part by the Bush Foundation, partnering with the St. Paul and Minnesota Foundation to announce the 2024 Bush Prize Minnesota winners. Green Card Voices, Minnesota Education Equity Partnership, and Minnesota Fund. More information about the winners and the Bush Prize is online at bushfoundation.org. Mostly cloudy overnight, lows 28 to 32, and partly sunny tomorrow, highs in the mid to upper 40s.
François-Philippe Champagne's job got a little trickier overnight. Mr. Champagne is Canada's industry minister. That puts him front and center as the Trudeau government prepares for Donald Trump's return to office as President of the United States. Mr. Trump's first term in office brought serious instability to Canada-U.S. relations. And now, the president-elect is promising to kick off his return with across-the-board tariffs and big immigration changes. We reached Industry Minister François-Philippe Champagne in Ottawa.
Minister, I wonder what kinds of questions Donald Trump's return to the presidency in the U.S. raises in your mind as Industry Minister.
Well, the first thing is making sure that the growth agenda that we have put forward, you know, over the last few months, we have engaged as Team Canada. You've seen me, you've seen a number of my colleagues, premiers, business leaders, union leaders, making the case for Canada and making sure that our colleagues in the United States, whether they're governors, senators, mayors, member of Congress or the Senate, or part of the Republican team, understand the strategic importance of Canada, you know, moving a bit from the friendly neighbor to the north to the strategic partner for the 21st century.
So based on that kind of correspondence, the messaging back and forth that you were doing even ahead of this vote, you're not worried?
Well, I would say you always have to make sure that you put your case forward, because it's kind of asymmetrical. You know, we understand all that. You know, my job has been to connect the dots, making sure that governors understand that their auto plants depend on steel from Canada, that, for example, the semiconductors produced in New York depends on the packaging and testing that is done in Canada. That the energy that they need is coming from parts of the country in the West. That has been really what we've put forward, and certainly engaging with them and say, you know what, the world is very different than in the last Trump presidency. And in this world, we've called that the indispensable relationship. You know, there's many nations who'd like to qualify their relationship with the U.S. as special, but the way we've presented it is like we're indispensable. We're indispensable for security, we're indispensable for supply chain and resiliency, and we're indispensable if you want to have a growth agenda.
Donald Trump has said, as you well know, Minister, that he would impose a 10% tariff on everything coming into the United States, including most Canadian exports. The Canadian Chamber of Commerce says that would shrink the Canadian economy by $30 billion a year. So what do you say to Canadians who might be more worried than you are that this could cost them their businesses or their jobs?
Well, I understand their concern, no doubt about that. But what I would say to them is that you have the team at the helm of this country, which has the most experience and expertise to deal with the United States and certainly a Republican administration. We've done that. We stood up for Canada, and our workers and our industry will do the same. Now, I would say for those, that's why I was trying to make the case about the strategic relationship we have on supply chain, is that there's far more interdependence today than you had in the last Trump administration. And there's a better understanding, in my view, that a decision on one side of the border would have an impact on both.
So do you think that was an idle threat? Do you think that was just talk? You don't believe he's going to actually do it?
No, I would say you should always take very seriously what the president is saying. But what I'm saying, when you engage with his team and you talk about the Canadian exception in a way, because if you're so integrated, if you were to go forward on that, those who are going to pay are really U.S. consumers, because whether you're talking semiconductors, 80% of all the semiconductor packaged and tested in North America are packaged and tested in Canada. So if you're going to do that, that means that this is going to have impact on a number of industries. What about the critical minerals? What about the cobalt that you need from Ontario? What about the energy? So those are the type of things that we've put forward to make sure that people understand that it may make sense for them to look at that for other nations, but when you come to Canada, you have to say, hold on for a minute, because we're not only the friend neighbor, we're mm-hmm. so strategic. We depend on each other for the resilience of our economy.
Quebec's premier, as you may have heard, is warning that Trump's threats on immigration could spark a wave of migrants across the border into Quebec. And the Parti Québécois leader suggested just today millions of people might consider moving north. What do you say, even if there might be hyperbole there, what do you say to those concerns?
Listen, we're in day one since the election. I'm not going to engage in speculation. What I can say to Canadians is that we are well prepared. We are certainly in a position to defend the Canadian interest. And so I would say that they should take comfort that they have the best team at the helm to make sure that we can face any of these situations. We have the relationships. We have already made our case in the United States. And we're going to continue to defend our interests. But, you know, at this stage, I'm not sure it's helpful to try to speculate about what may happen. We're in day one, so we're going to see. As you know, President Trump is not sworn in before the month of January in 2025. So there's a number of weeks to engage with his teams and the transition team to make sure that we defend Canadian interests.
And just finally, Minister, the Prime Minister had a majority mandate the last time. He was contending with a Trump presidency. In a minority government situation, even as some Liberal MPs have been calling on the Prime Minister to step aside, is this going to be harder this time around?
Well, nothing is in a way that, you know, there's things going to change for sure. We will need to adapt. We'll need to make sure that we engage. We will continue to defend and stand up for Canadian values and Canadian interests and Canadian workers and industry. What I think people should take comfort in is, like, people like me, I was foreign minister for part of President Trump's presidency. Minister Freeland was there, Minister Jolie. You have people in cabinet and in government that have dealt with a Republican administration. So we have the experience, we have the expertise. We've been preparing for months with Team Canada, with business leaders, premiers. So I would say we are well prepared, and that should give comfort to Canadians. Yes, there might be things that will come from time to time, which you should expect when you have such a broad-based relationship. But what you want to make sure is that the people at the helm have the experience and the expertise to deal with whatever may come. And I think we have demonstrated that time and time again.
Minister, I appreciate your time. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
François-Philippe Champagne is Canada's Minister of Innovation, Science and Industry. We reached him in Ottawa. Like much of the United States, Montana is a sea of red tonight. Donald Trump won the state's 4 electoral votes yesterday, and notably a U.S. Senate seat flipped to the Republicans. But pockets of blue remain, among them Missoula, where Democratic state lawmaker Zoe Zephyr has been reelected to the Montana House of Representatives. Ms. Zephyr was first elected in 2022, making her Montana's first openly trans legislator. But she hasn't spoken on the House floor since April 2023, when her Republican colleagues sanctioned her after she said passing a ban on gender-affirming care would leave them with, quote, blood on their hands, unquote. The legislature didn't meet this year, so she hasn't returned to the floor since. But now that she's been reelected, she will be able to debate next year. We reached Zoe Zephyr in Washington, D.C.
Representative Zephyr, you won your race, but from where you sit, does today feel like a win?
You know, like a lot of politics, I think there are different moods locally and nationally. Obviously, what happened with Trump is very scary for the country. But locally in Montana, we picked up 9 seats in the House of Representatives and broke the Republican supermajority. We also enshrined the rights to an abortion explicitly into our Constitution. And so right now, what we are wrestling with is wins at the local level, wins for strong progressive policy, and also a country that embraced an openly authoritarian leader in the last 24 hours.
Donald Trump and his supporters have pushed anti-trans rhetoric throughout this campaign. So as an openly trans person, an openly trans politician living in the United States, what are you weighing? How are you feeling?
You know, we knew that the fight for trans rights was going to be a long one. We had seen the rise of hate start in 2016. And really take full throttle in the early 2020s. And so we knew that there would be a fight going forward, regardless of who won. However, it is clear that those who have been pushing anti-trans policy are going to feel emboldened and are going to try to run even crueler policies. But the members of the trans community that I know, those of us who are in this fight, are not going to stop fighting. And that was true regardless of who won.
Given what happened when you were first elected and what you faced at that time, as our listeners heard about, were reminded of just a moment ago in the introduction, will you do anything differently? I mean, how do you prepare for this session?
No, you prepare for the session with all the litany of bills that are going to be coming forward. But I think specifically about, as representatives, as elected officials, we try to push for the policy that our constituents and our communities have asked us to be champions for. But we also, you know, when you get into elected office, you fundamentally believe in democracy, in elected representation. And so we, as I walk into that room, I will be thinking about pushing back. How do we push back against those who seek to erode the foundational principles of democracy? And how do you push back against someone, an aspiring authoritarian like Donald Trump, and those who at the state level will see, who look to recreate that type of authoritarian rhetoric in our state?
You care about these issues. I can certainly hear that in your voice, but you've also described this environment yourself as cruel. You've had people lie to authorities or deceive them so that police come to your home. You've been misgendered intentionally by Republican colleagues. Why did you come back a second time?
I came back a second time because I love my state, I love my city, and I believe that we need to have people fighting to make the change that we believe in. And you cannot stop cruelty from happening. You cannot make a legislator or a politician or your neighbors be kinder, gentler people all the time. You can try, you can plant those seeds. But when you're unable to do so, you must bear witness and reveal that cruelty. And I think a lot of what we are going to see in America in 2025 is organizers, politicians on the left, trying to build community and trying to make sure that those who want to push hateful, divisive policies do not get to do so in the dark.
Throughout the campaign, many voters expressed concerns about affordability and the economy. That was the issue for them as they cast their ballots. What, if anything, do you think your party could or should have done to reassure those voters and perhaps bring them over to your side and secure a different outcome?
And I think, again, this goes to the disconnect between, you know, three-time Senator John Tester losing his Senate reelection by 7 or 8 points, and an abortion amendment to enshrine the right to abortion in our Constitution passing by a similar margin. And what I see there is a disconnect between a party and progressive policies. And I believe the Democrats are closer to those progressive policies than the Republican Party is, certainly. Republicans have not been championing the right to abortion. However, I think it is incumbent for those of us on the left to push to make sure we have a viable left, that we can articulate the way in which pushing for housing policy, pushing for tenants' rights, and that those kinds of issues can be make a clear distinction for the path that the left offers this country.
You're used to being a minority Democratic lawmaker in a Republican-dominated chamber. That is the position Democrats in the U.S. Senate now find themselves in. What is your advice to them to navigate that?
My advice for them to navigate that is do not abandon your values in hopes of peeling away one or two votes from a Republican Party that has openly and willingly embraced an authoritarian like Donald Trump. You will find that those who bill themselves as moderates within the Republican Party are always present, but they are never enough. And it is incumbent on us in the Democratic Party to make sure that we are espousing our values and we do not bend to an authoritarian like Trump who will consume and take and take and take and will not be satisfied with one concession, but will demand all of them.
On the national level, I know you're also celebrating the election of Democrat Sarah McBride, who will become the first openly transgender person to serve in Congress. You captured about 80% of the vote in Missoula. When you're thinking about trans youth, young people in your state, or others who are concerned about the outcome of this election, what is your message to them?
You know, my message to them is the same message I gave when the anti-trans bills came forward in Montana, which is stay alive. We are in a fight that will be generational. I think back to 2004 with Bush winning re-election and the shift that happened there around the fight for gay rights. And it was a decade of fighting after 2004 until we got Obergefell and we got Democrats proudly championing the right for gay marriage. I think we are in that space now. And so my hope is that if you are a trans youth in this country, that you turn to people within your community, try to find connections to uplift and support you, and stay alive.
Representative Zephyr, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That was re-elected Montana state lawmaker Zoe Zephyr in D.C. There's a new commemorative $2 coin going into circulation, and in the Toonies' bright blue center is an image of the spirit of the sea, alongside a walrus, two beluga whales, a seal, and an Arctic char. The design is an homage to the Inuit homeland, the Nunungut. It was unveiled yesterday in Ottawa. Here's graphic artist Tumas Imanyuk, one of four Inuit artists who helped design the coin, talking about what it represents.
Most of the time, you'll see Inuit communities between the water and the land. So we're at the coastline. We depend on animals that are both inland and in the water. And often water is populated with resources, animals, mussels, seaweed, anything that is consumable and usable as material. So these animals we live with, we respect them. When we have to kill them, it is for eat. Even when we're little kids, we're told, if you kill, you have to eat it. How does it feel? I was emotional when it was given to me. I wasn't able to express how I felt. A lot was coming along, going through. And I think the validation that we're anyone like anyone else in Canada, that with different ethnicities, different cultures, we're all the same people. So I thought this was representative of that. I love it because when I work, when I create content, I may be stories, illustrations, and whatnot, I do it thinking that other cultures, they have beautiful things, wonderful things, and we too Inuit have such things. And I'm happy to share things from the Inuit culture, Inuit stories, and this will be one of them.
That was graphic artist Tumas Umanyuk, one of four Inuit artists who helped design the new commemorative toonie, speaking to the CBC's Sandra Abma. Alberta is famous for its tough stance on rats. According to the provincial government, it has been rat-free since 1950. Although, of course, being smallish and crafty, a few have gnawed through its defenses over the years. Now the government has launched a Rats on Rats drive, asking Albertans to participate in a public surveillance campaign and report any rodents that somehow managed to sneak in. Even though reports haven't always made for good leads, last year 450 rat sightings were reported in Alberta, but just 23 were confirmed to be rats. Karen Wickerson has fielded her share of those calls. She's a rat and pest specialist with the Alberta government. Ms. Wickerson spoke with Neil last year when a few stray rats had made their way to Calgary recycling depots.
Rats do get into the province. I can't inspect every vehicle coming into the province along the highway. But when they are discovered in Alberta, we work to permanently eradicate them.
Is this the worst you've seen in a long time?
Yeah, I've been in this position for 4 years, so definitely these are the biggest infestations I've had to deal with. The other probably most prominent infestation that people would be aware of was in 2012 at the Medicine Hat landfill, and that took 2 years to eradicate.
So what's the game plan here?
We're just being diligent. You know, we are in the facility every week. The facility has a pest control company. And we go in every week and monitor and basically change things up if they need to be. If we need to be looking at different areas of the facility to place traps and bait, then we do that.
Have you seen them?
On a couple occasions, yes.
How many are there? I mean, ballpark, or how many have you killed?
You know, it's really hard to put a number on it. We just go on reports from the staff working within the facility and then the bait consumption.
So since the 1950s, Alberta has had protocols in place to make it rat-free as much as possible. What is the secret in the province?
Yeah, you know, the biggest secret is that we started right when rats got to the border. The program was established. And we have legislation in place that states that every Albertan is responsible for controlling them because they are declared a pest in Alberta. So we're lucky.
And what's the monitoring like now?
You know, a lot of it is public reporting to me. I have an email set up. Also, we still do patrol the Alberta-Saskatchewan border and inspect the first 8 kilometers westward from the border, from Cold Lake all the way down to Montana, twice yearly, so, you know, in the spring and fall. Most of the reported rats I see per year are single rats, mm-hmm. and the rats that have hit stride on vehicles from outside of the province. So they're single rats.
The makings of a animated film. I see here. But.
Exactly. Yes, we could. There are many different versions that we could make. And we know that there are rats all around us, essentially, in the jurisdictions all around us. So, you know, it's just something where we have to be very vigilant about and encourage people to report to us if they think they see a rat.
From our archives, Alberta rat specialist Karen Wickerson speaking to Neil last year.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.
You can hear As It Happens weekdays from 6 until 7 here on KAXE. Getting into some On the River in just a moment. So let's do a check-in on our Current temperatures around the area and looking at our forecast as well. Right now, it is cloudy all across the board. We have a low of down to 36 in Hibbing and a high of 45 in Brainerd. It is 42 in Bemidji and 44 in Grand Rapids. Looking like, let's see, cloudy should remain that way throughout the night. We have lows down around 30. Partly sunny tomorrow. Highs for Thursday in the mid to upper 40s. And then for our final day of the week, sunny skies for Friday. And highs in the low 50s. We also have haven't been on the river in the evening for a little while. It's a dark start to the show, which fits in very well with our question of the week. Now that our days